From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, remembering Flight 255 on this 30th anniversary of one of America's worst air disasters.
Can you imagine a plane at takeoff literally yawing back and forth from 15 to 90 degrees? You know, that's just at going at like 500 miles an hour.
I'll never forget it. I've never seen anything like it before or since, that the plane was just crashed up against the bridge.
Speed limits have been bumped up on some Michigan freeways, but MDOT says safety concerns should be directed at distracted driving.
You know, just as our automakers do miracle things to make our cars safer, then we find new technology and miracle ways to distract ourselves.
And 48 years after it first began, the Ann Arbor Blues Festival is being resurrected. Those stories and more, but first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was supposed to be a routine flight from Detroit Metro Airport to Phoenix and then on to John Wayne Airport in Orange County, California. But moments after takeoff, Northwest Flight 255 stalled and crashed in flames onto Middle Belt Road. Everyone aboard was killed with one exception, 4-year-old Cecilia Sheehan. Two motorists on Middle Belt Road were also killed. The total death toll, 156. It was 30 years ago this day that Flight 255 crashed. Here's how CBS reporter Richard Roth told America about the disaster.
Northwest Flight 255 last night, bound for Phoenix in Southern California, was barely airborne when eyewitnesses said it banked and rolled, smashing to a road north of the airport in a fiery explosion.
The thing was on fire, the trees, the grass, cars. You could see parts of everything just laying all over. It was terrible.
It blew up. It just blew apart, and there was just a great big wall of flame going down across the field over there.
Two reporters who covered Flight 255 are here with us now. Roger Martin was a Detroit News reporter who was one of the very first on the scene. Roger, welcome to Stateside. Glad to have you with us.
Great to be here.
And Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta was there as a reporter for UPI, United Press International. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, Cindy.
Roger, that MD-82 crashed about 8:46 p.m. on that Sunday evening in 1987. When and how did you get word about the crash, and when did you get to the scene?
I was laying in bed, reading, enjoying a beautiful Michigan August summer night, and I think I had just finished watching the Tigers clobber the Kansas City Royals. The Tigers were having a really, really good year, so everybody was like pumped up about the Tigers, and the phone rang. This was before cell phones, of course. The phone rang, and it was the Detroit News City Desk, and it was Nolan Finley, who is now obviously editorial page editor of the news, still there, saying, "Get your butt to Metro Airport. This just happened," and off I went.
Rick, how about you?
I was getting to the end of my shift at UPI, and we were in the old Free Press building on Lafayette Boulevard in downtown Detroit when we got word that something had happened at Metro Airport. And my car actually wasn't working. I had to borrow the car of one of my colleagues, and I got onto 94, and it was just, you know, traffic was at a standstill. So I pulled onto the shoulder and drove until I got to a Wayne County sheriff's deputy who was, I should say, directing traffic, but really just stopping it. And the sheriff's deputy told me that, you know, he was driving on 94 when he saw the fireball in the sky, and he just stopped traffic. So he allowed me to continue on 94, and I got there until I got to the bridge over Middle Belt Road. And I'll never forget it. I've never seen anything like it before or since, that the plane was just crashed up against the bridge, and it was just, you know, large and medium-sized sheet metal smoldering. And I remember being struck by the fact that I couldn't see any bodies or victims or anything like that. And at that point, I still didn't know that almost everyone on board had been killed or that there was just the one survivor. And so I took in the scene for a while and then headed over to the airport where, you know, there was the an emergency operations center that had been, you know, set up to deal with the aftermath of the crash.
Roger, what are your strongest memories of what you first saw and heard?
What I recall was when I got down there, 94 and 275 had been closed as a result of the crash. It was, as Rick said, 94 was at a complete standstill. And But I grew up in the area. I grew up at I-94 and Southfield Freeway. That's Northern Allen Park. Mm-hmm. So I knew every back road to Metro Airport that was in existence at the time. So I remember going back roads and back roads, and I was able to finally get there. And when I finally got to a phone, I think I called from like a, maybe it was a gas station with a 7-Eleven, and I called the desk and I said, okay, Nolan, I'm here. And at that point, they had dispersed a bunch of other reporters out there as well. And I was given orders to then go to Saginaw, where the plane had just come from.
Right.
That's where it had, so they wanted me to go there. And I was already told that don't worry about the sort of breaking news aspect of this. We'll worry about that down here. You need to go find out why this thing crashed. And, you know, as someone who was trained as a journalist, I don't know that I'd ever heard the word metallurgy in my life, and I knew nothing about plane aerodynamics or anything mechanical. And so, you know, I went on to Saginaw to see if there was any service done at the plane there, try to interview anyone on the ground I possibly could from Northwest Airlines ground team. And I remember, too, by the time I got there, it was like 12:30, 1 o'clock at night, and the airport was closed. So I had nothing. I mean, I couldn't even get up to the airport. It was gated off and closed. So checked into a hotel, called the desk, and they said, wait, just wait.
I stop and you touched on this, that this was in the days before cell phones and before smartphones with video and camera capability and internet. Rick, how was a breaking news story like this covered? There you are at Metro Airport, this holocaust happening at Middle Belt and I-94. How do you cover a story like that in the days before cell phones and internet?
Well, something like this is an all-hands-on-deck situation, and I was the primary person there for UPI, but other news organizations, radio, TV stations, the news and the free press had flooded people in there, and Roger and I were talking about this earlier. There was a payphone at Metro Airport, and the Detroit news reporters got hold of it, and once they had that payphone, they would not relinquish it. There was just always someone there talking about something. I don't know if it was the plane crash or the Tigers or whatever, but they were told to hang on to the phone line and not let it go. In the meanwhile, other journalists, including me, are outside banging on the booth, you know, telling them to let it go because we all had to call our desks.
Ultimately, Roger, I know you spent this year and a half looking into this, and remind everyone again, once the NTSB came up with a cause for the crash, what was it?
Well, the NTSB will never come up with a cause for a crash. They will come up with what a probable cause for the crash. They will never say for certain why something went down, unless it was obviously terrorism or an act of war or something like that. But you learn when a plane of this size goes down, it's usually for a confluence of reasons. It's usually not just one thing. And that's exactly what happened with Flight 255. First, as pilot error, it appeared quite clear that pilot error was a primary cause of all this. You know, before a plane takes off, there's a checklist that pilots are supposed to go through when they're sitting on, you know, at the gate. One person in the cockpit will say flaps, and the other person will say check, and slats. Person will say check. Now, flaps and slats are obviously, they are what are deployed when a plane is taking off or landing to give the plane more buoyancy so it can lift off faster and at a steeper angle without losing control or landing softer. And in this instance, from all indications, the pilot, the cockpit, failed to follow that checklist, even go through it, and they failed to deploy the flaps and slats on a plane that was literally almost full to capacity, taking off from the shortest runway at Metro Airport. So that was number one. But, you know, planes like this always have multiple backup systems. And when you configure the plane incorrectly, and you're taking off and you hit a certain speed, a warning is supposed to go off, a very loud, audible warning telling you, man, you screwed up. Mm-hmm. You better make this change now or you're in trouble. That's not what it says, but it's a clear indicator. So the warning never went off. It never went off. And what we found in our reporting and what the NTSB found in its examination of the crash was a circuit breaker manufactured at the time by a company owned by Texas Instruments. It was a P40 circuit breaker. Probably failed and did not allow that warning system to go off. And we found in our reporting, and the NTSB found as well, that the Texas Instruments had issued three letters to every airline that had that P40 circuit breaker on one of its planes saying, you better check this thing because we're having problems with it. So you've got those sort of confluence of things going together here. Plane took off, couldn't get high enough, never got more than 50 feet off the ground. Hit a light pole at an Avis rental car building at the edge of the airport, and then, you know, Rick accurately described what happened next.
Well, the left wing hit the roof of the car rental agency, and then the plane started to, I guess, wiggle in the air before it went down on Middle Belt.
Can you imagine a plane at takeoff literally yawing back and forth from 15 to 90 degrees? You know, that's just at going at like 500 miles an hour. That's just
what those moments must have been like. And then for both of you, what you saw at that time, did it hit you afterwards? Because I'm guessing you were in reporter mode. I have to get facts. I have to do my job. And I'm thinking of hard stories and loss of life stories that I've covered where on the way home, I would cry my way home after I'd finish. Did it hit you after?
Yes, absolutely. You know, at first thinking that everyone had died, and then just, you know, the poignance of the only survivor being a little girl who had, you know, lost all of her immediate family. And although the story turned out to be apocryphal, that originally it was thought that perhaps in the final moments before the flight crashed, that Cecilia Sheehan's mother actually shielded her from the, you know, from the full effects of the crash and saved her life. In fact, her family was, you know, near her, but not on her. And so it seems as if her life was actually saved by a stranger.
How did it hit you, Roger?
Honestly, it's every once in a while I still think about it. I mean, every time I go to Metro Airport, and I fly out of there frequently, and I fly into there frequently, every time I go past Middle Belt Road, again, as someone who grew up downriver, our neighborhood was, every plane that took off and landed of any size, we heard. When I was growing up, I mean, it's just part of life in that part of downriver Detroit, and it's something I will never forget.
Hard to believe 30 years ago this day. Rick Pluta, Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, and Roger Martin, who's partner at Martin Waymire, a Lansing-based public relations firm. Thanks to both of you for sharing those really tough memories of Flight 255 30 years ago this day. Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks.
Flight 255 is now the fifth deadliest air crash in U.S. history. Cecilia Sheehan Crocker is married and in the 2013 documentary Sole Survivor says she is happy, she's doing well, and has a tattoo of an airplane on her wrist. A 30th anniversary vigil happens tonight at 8:46 at the memorial site located on a hill at I-94 and Middle Belt in Romulus. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
If you ever hear the terms Great Lakes and smuggling, you might think of whiskey running during the Prohibition. But did you know there was a different kind of smuggling along the Wisconsin border until the late 1960s? It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And back with us today is Rachel Clark. So, Rachel, the smuggling we're about to discuss does not involve guns or alcohol or beaver pelts, but rather?
Oleomargarine.
Oleomargarine.
Yes.
Well, I know our younger listeners are going, oleomargarine? What is oleomargarine? So as probably the resident senior, I'm going to explain, because I remember doing this with my grandmother. You would have a brick of white stuff, and in it was a little button, and you would squeeze it, and phew, out would come a yellow dye, and you would knead it together, and you had yellow oleomargarine, which I believe, I love the description that it was the working man's spread. So how did this become illegal?
Well, when margarine came out, it was a cheap substitute for butter. So the butter industry began lobbying for rules and regulations against its sale and distribution, and these laws were particularly strict in Wisconsin. So people started going into Michigan from Wisconsin and the UP and buying up oleomargarine and bringing it home with them. So there was a smuggling ring right at the border of Dickinson County.
When you think that margarine was developed during Napoleon's time in France, so was there a butter cartel trying to block the insidious spread of margarine?
Not quite that bad. It got pretty interesting, though, in the late 1800s. Napoleon III found he needed to feed his troops and the people of France with something cheaper than butter, more readily available than butter, and that lasted longer. So he put out almost this competition with a money prize to somebody that could come up with something. And so a French chemist named Hippolyte Mesmery, sorry if I just butchered his name.
Very good.
he came up with this butter substitute that we know today as oleomargarine.
Amazing. What were the tactics that were used and the arguments used to keep people from buying this yellow oleo?
It's kind of entertaining to look at it today. The butter industry started out with a tax at oleomargarine as being lowbrow and low class, evil and threatening to human and public health. And then in the mid-1880s, you start to actually see laws on the books, taxes and tariffs against the ingredients in oleo. You also get laws in Michigan where places that sell and produce oleo, they actually have to put signs up that say, "We use oleo," because they were saying, "Hey, we have great butter," and it wasn't butter. And there weren't any laws against that at the time.
So truth in advertising.
Absolutely. And then finally in the 1890s, it becomes completely illegal in Michigan to manufacture or distribute oleomargarine. But those laws are impossible to regulate. People were doing it anyway. And so they start to lighten up a little bit in Michigan with it. By the mid-20th century, it starts to wane a little bit.
So Michigan lightened up, Wisconsin didn't. So there's this, you know, contraband smuggling of oleomargarine into Wisconsin.
There is. Some of the more interesting things, too, had to do with the color, as you mentioned earlier. Oleo, in its norm, sort of natural form, if you will, is a white color. And so they would add yellow. It actually started out in the company, they would add yellow coloring. And that was false advertising, according to Michigan law. And so the Congress actually imposed a tax on anything that was using yellow dye. And so margarine manufacturers just started using vegetable oil instead of animal oil in their product, and then adding these little packets so you could color it at home. So they were avoiding that tax by letting the public and the consumers color it at home.
I didn't. And who knew that when my grandmother was letting me help her knead that package of margarine, we were beating a tax.
Yep, absolutely.
So when did this stop being a thing?
Well, as I said, in the mid-20th century, oleo starts winning out. The Depression made it so people had to look at cheaper alternatives to butter, and oleo was that natural sort of, or not natural, but with that, that obvious cheaper option. At that time, you start seeing products like Parquet and Blue Bonnet. They come up in the 30s and 40s as these margarine spreads. And then World War II, the butter that is being produced in the United States is being shipped off to soldiers in Europe. So again, you get this increase in the use of oleo. And then by the 1960s, American laws start to lessen as a whole, and you can have them in public institutions and schools, and the military can use it in cooking. So for the whole United States, except for Wisconsin, by the 1960s, the laws against oleo have lightened up, if not gone away entirely.
And do we know if Wisconsin has finally dropped its legal opposition to oleo?
I think they have. I imagine if I looked closely, there would still be laws on the books in Wisconsin, but I think they finally realized the same thing that Michigan did, that it's really hard and expensive to pursue lawsuits against companies or individuals that are violating these laws. But the smuggling continued up through the 1960s and into the early 70s. Wisconsin people would drive into Iron Mountain or Kingston in the Upper Peninsula, buy as much oleomargarine as they could, and then drive it back home into Wisconsin.
That's the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Thanks so much, Rachel, for sharing this story of oleomargarine smuggling from Michigan's not-too-distant past. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In 1969, the Blues threw a party in Ann Arbor. Enough people came that it happened again and again and became the Ann Arbor Blues Festival, later rechristened the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival before its last hurrah in 2006. But now it is back. The Ann Arbor Blues Festival is happening Saturday, August 19th at the Washtenaw Farm Council Fairgrounds. And as they like to say, making Ann Arbor gyrate again. Here with us now is the founder of the Ann Arbor Blues Society, James Partridge. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And we want to welcome one of the musicians who will be performing at the Blues Festival, Blair Miller, who, as we're going to hear a little bit, has a very, very personal link to those early years of the Ann Arbor Blues Festival. Blair, hello.
Hi, Cynthia. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both. James, that musical happening in August 1969. It's considered to be the first electric blues festival in the world. What is electric blues? What's that mean?
Well, it's a form of blues that is amplified. It was what's it called, electric or city blues, the Chicago-style blues, which is distinguished from the more acoustic and the country-style blues that was very popular before then.
So what caused that first festival to happen back in 69?
It was an interesting story. There was a group of students at the University of Michigan who had been very involved in the music scene, largely in the folk music scene, from what I understand. And in 1968, they got together and decided that they wanted to put on a sort of music festival. I don't think that they were specific as to precisely the type of music festival that they wanted to put on, and someone had suggested a blues festival. So some of the organizers got together. They actually took a trip to Chicago. They met with some record studio executives, got taken to the south side of Chicago and visited clubs, were introduced to some of the amazing performers at the time who were playing in small clubs, but not widely known outside of that area. They fell in love with the music. They decided this was exactly the type of thing to do and to bring back to Ann Arbor. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So who showed up to play at that first festival? I'm curious, what did it do that it had not been done before?
Well, the first festivals had some of the most incredible names in blues ever. At the time, many of them weren't as widely known. Now, there was B.B. King, who was very well known, of course, and Muddy Waters was there. But there were also artists like Luther Allison, for example, who was a relative unknown at the time. He had a couple of singles out, but no major albums or anything. And when he came to the University of Michigan, they actually brought him to the university, and he played in the student union before the first festival, just to sort of introduce the students and the population to city blues and to Chicago-style blues.
Wet their whistles, as we used to say.
Exactly. Yeah. And the story goes is that when he first started to play, the room was relatively empty. But within an hour of him playing, word had gotten out, and it was the equivalent of going viral at the time. And before he was finished, the room was packed, standing room only. He was that good, and he just captured the imaginations and the attention of the population.
And so thus was launched the Ann Arbor Blues Festival. Blair, I understand you were at the festival the next year in 1970?
That's correct, yep.
And you were 19.
I was.
What do you remember most about that day?
I remember it was hot and dusty, but the energy there was just unbelievable, and being around legends of the blues was so exciting. And I had heard blues covers by the British bands and the American bands of the day, like the Doors and the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Cream. To hear the authentic stuff was at the festival, I remember, was just blew me away.
And you've been playing guitar since you were 14.
Yeah.
Did the music you made start changing after that?
Yeah, it did. I started to work on and learn more traditional style of playing, not quite country at that point. I was still sort of morphing into being more of a Delta blues style player. And so it was kind of a cross between the urban blues and the country blues.
Over Judgment Day, if I had possession over Judgment Day, the woman I'm loving, she wouldn't have no right to pray.
You know, James, it's kind of funny to think about just what Blair alluded to, that so many of the rock groups that were huge at that time in 1969, The Who and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and The Doors and Cream, we can go on and on, hugely influenced by the very blues artist who performed at the Ann Arbor Blues Festival, the artists who were largely unknown to white audiences here in America.
Yeah, it's true. One of the things that I found that was really interesting as I was researching the origins of this is these blues artists, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, they were huge in the UK and in Europe long before they were well known to the people here in the United States. And you know, the story is, of course, that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards met on a train while he was holding a blues album, and that sparked the conversation. And there's this other story that when they came to the United States, they went to Chess Records in Chicago to visit and to meet some of these artists who had influenced them after they had gotten popular. And Muddy Waters was in the studio painting. He was in overalls and painting the ceiling. And he saw Mick Jagger and he said, "Oh, well, let me get your bags for you, Mr. Jagger," because he recognized him right away. But Mick Jagger knew who he was. And he said, no, we're going to carry your stuff. What are you doing painting the ceiling? The dichotomy between how the British viewed the blues artists compared to how they were recognized here in the United States was striking. And that was one of the really neat things that the Ann Arbor Blues Festivals was able to do, which was to bridge that gap and to bring these artists who were so popular and who had so influenced rock and roll, the British invasion, and bring that music to a largely white audience and mainstreamed it in a lot of ways and helped propel those artists and that music into the ears of a new generation.
And James, you say the impact of the Ann Arbor Blues Festival is still being felt today, nearly 50 years later. Why is that?
Well, I think, first of all, the Ann Arbor Blues Festival was the first blues festival ever. And I like to say that, that to me is a legacy that is significant. But the music that we hear today, in many instances, grew out of the fact that the Ann Arbor Blues Festivals helped re-energize and revitalize and introduce music to the white audience. And it enabled those musicians who previously may have been playing on what was called the Chitlin' Circuit at a time to become popular, to develop some wealth, to allow them to continue in the profession that they had chosen. And so they were able to create more music. And there's just been a cascading effect from that. People who were at the blues festivals became technicians in the music. They went into the music industry. Blair learned how to play the blues and is now performing blues at the festival. These ripples just expand through time, and that is so significant, and that's why I find it so important to bring this festival back.
And Blair, you spent years as a medical social worker, but now you are focused on performing the blues, and you're going to, as James said, perform at the Revive Blues Festival August 19th. That must be a poetically sweet feeling for you.
Yeah, it definitely is a full circle kind of feeling. I went to school at the University of Michigan, and I got my master's of social work there. And and having been at one of the first Ann Arbor Blues Festivals, yeah, it's a feeling of satisfaction and completion, sort of a cycle. And the reason that I started playing out is because I have a passion, as James does, and as the Blues Festival, part of its purpose is to continue carrying the blues, and spreading the word and getting information out about the blues and how important is a bedrock of our American music it is.
James, as with Blair being set to play on the 19th, who will be joining him? Who else is in the lineup?
We've got a tremendous lineup. One of the people that I am incredibly excited about is Benny Turner and Real Blues. And not only am I excited about it because he happens to be a fantastic musician in his own right, is because Benny played at the 1972 Blues and Jazz Festival in Ann Arbor and was heard on the record that was recorded by Atlantic Records. And so I'm very interested in bridging the gap between the old festival and the new festival and establishing that continuity and paying respect to the people who performed and to the people who put on the festival and to acknowledging the role that the city has played in and are in the legacy of the blues. That is very significant to me. And Benny exemplifies that. And the other reason that I'm really excited about Benny is because he's bringing with him a 14-year-old blues prodigy named Brandon Niederauer, who recently completed a run on Broadway in the musical School of Rock. And so this connection between the young and the old, the past and the present, is so meaningful and so symbolic. It's very important to honor that tradition and to respect where this festival came from and give it its due.
You can get all the details on the Ann Arbor Blues Festival happening August 19th. Just go to the website, a2bluesfestival.com. James Partridge, founder of the Ann Arbor Blues Society, and blues artist Blair Miller, who will be performing. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you so much for
having
us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, speed limits on some Michigan roads have gone up, but don't push your luck.
I think a lot of people think, okay, I set my cruise control at 8 miles over whatever it is now. So if it was 70, I'm going 78. So if it's 75, I'm going 83. And I think the state police would say, uh-uh, doesn't work that way.
That comes up in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 1960, the first oral contraceptive was approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. That drug, Enovid, changed the course of history for women. Beverly Strassman has a challenge for the drug companies that make hormonal birth control. Don't rest on your laurels. Her research indicates it may be past time for pharmaceutical companies to tweak the formulation of the pill. Beverly Strassman is a professor of anthropology and a researcher at the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research. Welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
What questions were you seeking to answer in your new study?
Okay, well, it built on a prior study where I worked in Mali, West Africa, and I showed that the Dogon people have very different reproductive patterns compared to what we have. And these patterns are more similar to those of probably our ancestors over the evolutionary past up until about 100 years ago. And so the change in our reproductive patterns is probably involved in the epidemic of breast cancer that we have in the United States and other countries today. And so my prior research looked at the number of menstrual periods that women have over their lifetimes when they're not using any form of contraception. And I found that the West African women I studied had only about 100 periods, whereas North American women have about 400. Mm. And this increase in number of periods is associated with an increase in hormonal exposure. And anything that increases hormonal exposure, of which another factor is an early age at menarche, in other words, an early age at first menstrual period, anything that increases hormonal exposure, for example, the first menstrual period, initiates kind of the ovaries to get into a state where they produce hormones.
Kicks them into action.
It kicks them into action. And there's a direct link between hormonal exposure and risk for breast cancer.
Certainly, we've heard a lot of talk recently about a correlation between hormone replacement therapy, HRT, connected to increased breast cancer risk. So this is looking at breast cancer pills or our hormonal levels?
Well, so what I did in my earlier work is I showed that in our evolutionary past, women probably had way lower hormonal exposure compared to what women are getting just from their own ovaries today. All right? Mm-hmm. So what I did in my recent study is I wanted to ask the question, all right, we're already kind of in a quandary because we're getting excessive amounts of hormonal exposure from our own ovaries. What happens when we go on the birth control pill?
And we get synthetic hormones.
Yes, exactly. We get a synthetic estrogen called ethanol estradiol, and we get synthetic progesterone. And so I wanted to know, does this further aggravate already a bad situation, or is it actually protective?
What'd you find?
Well, I did this project with the students in my human reproductive ecology course, and what we found is that several of the hormonal contraceptives that are out there today are dramatically increasing our exposures, particularly several compounds are increasing our exposure to synthetic progesterone by more than fourfold.
That's big.
That's big, yeah. And for some, it was eightfold and so on. So our concern is that the safety of hormonal contraceptives has not been sufficiently well established. And also, I feel that the drug companies should already have been ahead of the game and done the study that the students and I did. In other words, they should have already been able to answer this question. Are women getting more hormonal exposure when they don't take hormonal contraceptives and, say, use barrier methods of contraception, or their own ovaries giving them more? Or when you suppress a woman's own ovaries and instead give her synthetic hormones, does she get more? And it was extremely difficult for us to answer this question because the drug companies don't really even provide serum levels for hormones for women on the pill. Usually they provide those data only for the first and the last day of dosing. Hmm. And so they really should be providing serum levels for women on the pill throughout the menstrual cycle. And they should have more than 12 to 78 women in their samples because women are so diverse in terms of how they metabolize hormones and so on.
So what is the takeaway, Beverly, from your study, first for women?
Okay, well, I really want to make it clear that hormonal contraception has greatly improved women's lives, allowed an expansion of women's roles in the workplace, given women more control over when they reproduce and so on. So I'm totally all for it. But at the same time, millions of women take hormonal contraceptives worldwide, and it bothers me that the drug companies haven't done the research that's needed to establish the safety of these drugs. They need to do this research. They're resting on their laurels, as you said at the outset. Mm-hmm. And they're also not really being very forthcoming about the risks associated with the different formulations. And part of that is because they don't actually know. So the researchers who directly study cancer risk have to cope with incredible time lags of 20 years between when a new drug comes on the market and when they're able to actually assess whether or not it causes an increase in cancer risk. So that's why theoretical studies like mine, where we just look at hormone levels associated with the various compounds, can be of great value.
Beverly, what's the most important question that a woman on birth control pills should ask her gynecologist or her physician when she sees her doctor?
She should ask her doctor, why am I on this pill versus another alternative? What do you personally know about the cancer risks and the epidemiological data associated with the different formulations? And am I on this birth control pill for a kind of subsidiary reason? One reason might be acne. Is it worth it to be on this particular formulation for a kind of secondary reason other than prevention of pregnancy? And I would also encourage women to speak with their doctors about the non-hormonal intrauterine device to see if that's a good choice for them. And I totally understand that some women may shy away from the copper. But the other thing I'd like to say to women is that the most important thing to do to protect your health in this arena is to avoid getting sexually transmitted infections. And this includes using latex condoms or dental dams consistently and correctly. So I think that protecting against STDs to safeguard your health is something that shouldn't, you know, be forgotten when we focus on hormones in the birth control pill.
Beverly Strassman is the lead author of a University of Michigan study looking into how birth control pills affect the level of hormones in women's blood serum. Thanks for sharing your work with us, Beverly.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
We're driving around Michigan a little faster this summer. It's the result of a package of bills signed earlier this year by Governor Snyder. Speed limits are increasing to 65 miles an hour on 900 miles of non-freeways around the state, while on 600 miles of freeways, speed limits going up to 75. Jeff Cranson with the Michigan Department of Transportation is here now. Jeff, just why did the state legislature decide to increase speed limits?
So this has been in the works for a long time, some legislators. I think they felt like largely people are going that fast anyway, and they have a philosophy that some people in traffic operations do, especially some people that look at these things closely, that it's actually less safe if you create an incredible differential where most of the traffic is traveling at a certain speed and others are not. That's where you hear the discussion about the 85th percentile, which is widely misperceived. I think everybody hears that and thinks, well, 85% of the traffic is going this speed. What that actually means is nobody is exceeding that, or only 15% are exceeding that. So 85% of the traffic is going that speed or less. But from looking at that data and lots of studies and lots of discussions and lots of compromise with MDOT and the Michigan State Police working very closely, they agreed that it would be worth trying going from 70 to 75 on some rural freeways. Very predictable. You would have guessed without even hearing probably what they would be, and those are 127, 131, I-75, all north of the population centers.
Sure, that makes sense.
And so far, they have not tracked it. In fact, I checked with the state police to see if they've done any studies on whether the 85th percentile has changed on those, and so far they don't know that it has. But they also said everybody should keep in mind that the speed limit is a speed limit, and we are doing enforcement at the posted speed limit.
So new signs have gone up with the new limit, but that doesn't mean then you can push it even more.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people think, okay, I set my cruise control at 8 miles over whatever it is now. So if it was 70, I'm going 78. So if it's 75, I'm going 83. And I think the state police would say, uh-uh, doesn't work that way. There's no understood grace. And if you're going over the speed limit, you could be stopped. So what I'm curious and will be curious to see is after they do study this, if the people who were driving, say, 75 to 80 on those freeways, 75 up north, 131, 127, if that is what they continue to drive, or if people do decide to push it and go a little faster. So the jury's still out on that.
And this 85th percentile speed tool, that is not just a Michigan thing, right? This is the national standard for setting speed limits?
Well, yeah, and I'd hesitate to say standard, Cynthia. It's definitely a factor. It's one of the criteria, but traffic safety engineers will be quick to say that you've got to look at a lot of other things, and there's a lot in that index, and that includes the trajectory of the road. You know, is it mostly straight? Is it heavily curved? Are there a lot of hills? Traffic volumes? It definitely is a factor on how much traffic there is on any given road. There are people that are hardcore adherents to the 85th percentile and think nothing else should matter, but there are a lot of other people that say that's just one factor.
Now, this package of bills the governor signed last January was not without its detractors. There were people worried about cities and towns along those state roads with the higher limits and schools. What about those?
That concern about the two lanes and the roads, I would say that is a legitimate concern that's going to have to remain to be seen. I mean, so far, some of the two lanes have been posted, and these are all north of US 10. The only two-lane road that has had a speed limit change is M-231, which is the very new Grand Haven bypass in Ottawa County, and that was actually built to freeway standards because the long-term plan is for that to be a four-lane freeway, and so two of those lanes are now serving as the north-south route, but it's limited access, very straight, very flat, so they deemed that safe. But otherwise, all the roads that you're seeing are up north, M-37, M-55, M-115, M-65, M-72, M-77, M-28, east of Marquette. And there are little crossroads towns along there, and I think it's going to depend on enforcement and what police are able to do and the signs and people paying attention. But, yeah, that is part of the discussion. You know, you don't want people barreling through your town for safety reasons, and that's a concern. And they've worked out a lot of individual deals with school zones. And, I mean, school zones are still going to be posted at lower speeds, and those are going to be heavily enforced. I really think that those people were heard, those lobbies that weighed in on it. And so that's why the legislation really focused on those rural freeways and those rural two lanes where, you know, you're out in the open and it seems safe. But I think everything is going to be looked at and studied very, very closely. And if it turns out that crashes do go up, then you're going to probably see some changes to that. And some people will say, this is what we thought was going to happen. And crashes are up over all the last few years, as you know.
Yes, yes.
And that's because people are driving more. The economy has recovered and fuel is low, and there are a lot more miles driven. We also, you know, just as our automakers do miracle things to make our cars safer, then we find new technology and miracle ways to distract ourselves.
And that comes down to driver behavior, I'm sure, as do voiced concerns that the laws would just get everybody driving faster, including transforming freeways in urban areas like Metro Detroit into something like the MIS track in Brooklyn. But as you say, we're talking rural freeways. You've got to pay attention to these signs because speed limits have not changed on the big city freeways.
That's right. And whether that happens eventually or not remains to be seen. But I'm glad you said driver behavior, because that is the mantra of everybody from law enforcement officials to traffic safety officials. That's why the Associated Press changed their style from accident to crashes and said, let's call them what they are, folks. They're crashes, and that means that they were caused by driver behavior. There are no accidents. And, more than 90% of crashes do relate to driver behavior, and a lot of people don't realize that, you know, and we were kind of taught over the years to say accident as if, you know, it couldn't be avoided, but most can.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because some years ago, earlier in my career, when I had to do traffic reports, I used the word crash, and I had a listener email to scold me mightily for using that word crash, that it's an accident. But you're right. So much of what we just saw an awful fatality on US 23, where a mother and a daughter rear-ended and killed by someone distracted driving. It was not drunk driving, and police say it appeared the driver was texting.
Yeah, see, and you're going to see more of that. I think they have a hard time identifying that as a cause, but they're getting better at it. Mm. And it's every bit the concern that drunk driving has been over the years. And I think that it's good when the police identify that as a cause and let people know. And I think it's going to be, you know, used in driver's education programs and really drilled into our kids. And I mean, that's the whole thing about autonomous vehicles and connected vehicles and what MDOT and MEDC and other state departments are doing, you know, in partnership with the auto industry. Let's face it, the safest way we're going to drive and get around is to take that driver behavior out of the equation. And I think that those things can't happen soon enough. And you really start to understand that when your own kids start to drive.
Yeah, boy, amen to that. And you touched on this at the beginning, Jeff, with just kind of talking about the rationale behind the legislature bumping up the speed limits in some parts of the state, that I think we all have a good idea of the risk of driving too fast. But how about the risks of driving too slow? The person that is deliberately, you know, chugging along at 45 in that right lane of the freeway, or God forbid, the left lane.
Yeah, well, people do crazy things when they're frustrated, and that's when crashes happen, you know, when we're caught in congestion and when we're in a hurry. And that's why the state police do special enforcement on left lane driving. Because of that, you know, it's not just a courtesy, it's a real safety issue. If you're on the phone or distracted yourself for the reason, you're just kind of, you know, daydreaming and you're in the left lane and people start to pass on the right, it creates backups, it creates congestion, and it leads to, you know, errant driver behavior. So, yeah, all those things matter. And a lot of the people that I talked about before that are the adherents to the 85th percentile would say that it's unsafe to have too many people driving exactly at the speed limit if more people are driving 5 miles over. And those differentials do create unsafe situations. So, yeah, it's unsafe to drive too fast. It's unsafe to drive too slow. I mean, you're best off to pay attention and go with traffic and not be stubborn, you know, and not get in the left lane and think, hey, you know, I'm going the speed limit so I can just stay here. I mean, that's not only rude, it's unsafe.
Bottom line, has MDOT changed all the signs? I know there are a lot of logistics to making this all happen. Are we on board? And at this point, as we're talking, signs are all up to speed?
All those freeways are changed. They're still working on the two lanes. Several more of those will be complete by Labor Day. The remaining batch of the two lanes will probably be done by mid-November. But all of the four lane, you know, what you think of as the expressways, basically, you know, the routes that we take to our playground up north, those have all been changed.
Jeff Cranson, Michigan Department of Transportation, thanks so very much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.